Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Classical Ideas with Greg Soden. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. Today is a conversation about a life in Zen training. My guest in this episode is Corey Hess. I got connected to Corey through a mutual friend, Mado Moore, abbot of Kurinji Monastery in Wisconsin. Mado Roshi consistently shares links from Corey's fantastic blog, Zen Embodiment, and I noticed Corey posting regular comments and links on a Facebook group about Zen practice in the United States. I started reading the Zen Embodiment blog too, and found it to be unique and interesting. Corey's blog creatively and poetically talks about his Zen experience in Japan and the United States, and encourages others to dive in to their own unique inner process of embodiment and awakening. Corey's blog brings Zen off the cushion and into society, into parenting, into being married, into the professional world, and into his direct work of helping people in his body therapy work, doing structural integration, meditation instruction, source point, and craniosacral therapy. You can read his blog about Zen practice at www.zenembodiment.com. And you can find Corey's professional work for body therapy at www.coreyhessbodytherapy.com. Today's conversation with Corey is essentially a three-part conversation. The first part is Corey's backstory for how he found Zen after growing up in Michigan. The second part of our conversation is about his experience living in the Sogenji Zen Monastery in Okayama, Japan, where he was ordained a Zen monk and given the name Ichigen. The third part is about Corey's post-monastery life, his work, his family, and his writing. A large portion of our conversation today refers to documentary film footage shot by the Japanese national television network NHK, which is sort of comparable to the UK's BBC, over the course of a year at Sogenji. Corey is featured prominently in the 45-minute documentary, which you can find on his blog, on YouTube, and at the links provided in the show notes. After listening to this conversation, I highly recommend you watch the footage as a complimentary experience to listening to this conversation, because Corey's explanations over what happens in the film will greatly enhance your understanding as you watch. A large component of what I did to prepare for this conversation is to watch Corey's life in the footage and write questions about practices, daily routines, the social life among the monastics, and more. While you can enjoy the conversation without watching the footage, you will see the full splendor of Zen training by watching it. You can consider this conversation akin to watching a movie on DVD with the director's commentary turned on. That said, you do not need to watch the footage in order to enjoy this wide-ranging conversation about Corey's life at Sogenji. I love the far-reaching nature of this conversation, and am grateful to Corey for answering questions about monastic life in extremely minute detail. please follow the links in the show notes to find Corey's work and contact information. I know he'd love to hear from you. From about minute 43 to minute 47, I run into a little bit of a snag with the sound quality. I apologize. Lastly, stay tuned after the conversation for Corey's inclusion of a full chanting of the English version of the Heart Sutra. Please enjoy my conversation with Corey Ichigen Hess. Corey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Can you spend a moment and just introduce yourself a little bit to the audience? I know we're going to talk about a lot of your story today, but just kind of like who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm a former Zen monk, Rinzai Zen monk, and I spent pretty much all my 20s really deeply involved in Rinzai Zen in Japan and in the States. These days, I'm kind of just a dad. I have three daughters, and I also am a body therapist. I do structural integration and a few other modalities. Yep.
Cool. Where did you grow up?
I'm a Midwestern boy. I grew up in Michigan. Out in the woods. I didn't have any neighbors for about a quarter mile, and so I spent a lot of time out in the woods kind of investigating. You know, I think I was an early person to really want to investigate what's real and all that in life.
Awesome. Did you have any sort of like spiritual tradition growing up or any connection to any like traditions at all in your family?
We went to the local, you know, Baptist church, but I think I was really craving a lot of that from an early age, and that really wasn't a part of our lives in a big way. So I came in craving something deeper.
Okay. Yeah. So what would you say would be sort of like your first introduction to Buddhism in general? Because I know your life really went in that direction. Where did you first come into contact with like the teachings of the Buddha, Zen, and things like that?
Well, I think I had read, you know, Buddhism books in the public library or whatnot. But I think I saw one book one time in the library, and I think it was actually one of these really great books where they show the Japanese monastery, and I saw the monks, and I think they were, you know, all laying in a line sleeping, you know, and I was just totally blown away by. So if nothing else, just the aesthetic of it was very powerful. I think it really hit me in a certain way I didn't really understand.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's like the mountains and the robes and the shaved heads? Like, what do you think it was about it that really drew you in?
It was something very Spartan and very pure and not necessarily morally pure, but just something very, very kind of penetrating and sharp about it. I grew up with Star Wars, you know, I was looking to figure out how to be a Jedi or something in my life. So I think it was, I really was, looking for some kind of training of, you know, to be able to explore deeply what it is that's moving around, what it is that's, existing in space. And that, so I think that there was a training aspect. You know, I used to watch all these kung fu movies, you know, as a kid. So I was looking for some kind of deep trainings.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you think that you established like an actual practice in Buddhism?
Well, I don't think I really had a really, you know, real practice until I went to Japan.
Okay.
I had sat a few different O sessions, mm-hmm. and I think I had, you know, I'd been at the little monastery on Whidbey Island where I live. There was a little monastery called Tahoma One Drop, and I had been there, and I'd been sitting for a while, but, you know, to really get a really deep, you know, start to really investigate this practice takes, for me, it took a long time to even just to be able to sit there and be comfortable and really engage with it. So Japan, you're just thrown into the fire there.
Right.
So, you know.
So you went to a monastery, Sogenji, in your 20s, right?
Yep.
How old were you when you went? Do you specifically remember?
I think I was 23.
Okay, so what was your life like from maybe like your early 20s, like 20 to 23? Like, what was that point like leading you to the monastery? Because I think that's a really interesting process that a lot of people might be interested to hear about.
Yeah, I think I was looking for a way to, you know, offer myself to the world. And I was really an intense person, pretty, you know, artistic and pretty gifted with some athletics and physical, but there was some aspect of me that was kind of wound tight. And I felt like there was, you know, there are different parts of myself were not working together. I felt like I was going in a few different directions as a 20-year-old. And so we were wild and crazy. I went to school in Missoula, Montana. We were kind of like trying to be Jack Kerouac and trying to figure out how to, you know, be wild and crazy artists and live life to the fullest. But there was this part of me that really craved some kind of intense training of some kind. But then I got injured when I was in, I think I was a little bit after, no, I'm not sure what time that was, but I got injured and I had this whole physical problem with my hip. And, through that, I realized through some different, energetic practices that, oh, I have to really work on this in a deep way for a long time to sort myself out. And so I went looking for a way to do that. And that's when I, you know, really started to look for the Roshi. Mm-hmm. He's an energetic master. Okay. So his way of working is basically energetic. So I was going in a few different directions and I wanted to find a way to somehow work with that.
Okay. So was he attached to Sogenji and the monastery on the island that you're in?
So the Roshi is the abbot of the monastery in Japan, Sogenji, and there's a little satellite monastery from that one here. And there's a bunch around, there's a few around the world actually that he's the man, right? And then there are these little kind of one drops, kind of drops of water around. And first I came out from Missoula, I came out to all the way out here to Whidbey, and I came and I visited, and there was a head monk here, and I expected to find someone very nice and gentle, and instead he was sort of this handsome, sharp, kind of arrogant guy who kind of just pushed my buttons like crazy. And I said, "I'm getting the hell out of here. You know, I don't want to be involved in this. I just want to be like a cool guy and, you know, chase girls and happy." But it really hit me. It kind of like stung me. And so I left and I went traveling around and I was in places like Cuba and I was in Cuba. And I thought, why am I not happy? And I realized, oh, it's my internal world has to be sorted out. So it doesn't matter where I am if my internal world is uneasy. So I went back somehow after my departure. I went back and there was an O session happening at the monastery on Whidbey here, and the Roshi was here, and somehow he invited me to go to tea. Somehow maybe he heard about this weird guy that visited, you know, and the Roshi's looking for his new, you know, wild characters to mold.
Yeah.
So he invited me to tea and I went in and I couldn't believe it. It was just like meeting, you know, Yoda. Okay. He was moving from this place, which I completely could not grasp. Physically, he was so physically present, and it was like he was so grounded in this way that I couldn't even imagine. It just completely blew me away. And so, you know, he was just looking right through me. I would talk to him and he completely had me. You know, I was like a pawn in that room with this master, right?
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I said, well, why would a person like me go to train in Japan? And in his, you know, indescribably deep voice, he says, what do you think? You know, what do you think? And I said, well, it depends on the person, you know. And he says, you know, he says, no, it's to realize why you were born. Hmm. And I didn't really have, I had nothing. I couldn't do anything with that. I had zero understanding. And that shook me up. And then I stayed, he let me stay for the rest of the 4 days. It was a 7 day O session. He let me stay for the rest of the 4 days. And I sat in one of these knee chairs, you know?
Yeah.
I was just suffering, you know, just this like ball of like ki confusion and pain, you know? And then on the last evening, I had this, you know, opening, and it was like time stopped, and you know, it was a really big carrot for me. It was a carrot to show me, oh, this is possible with this, and you know, I could like read everybody's thoughts, and so you know, people have stuff like that when they start, you know, and for me, it was a real wake up, like, oh, this is a practice that I could really dive into, mm-hmm. Okay. But then I left, and I was on my brother's couch in Seattle the next night, you know, like, you know, but then, oddly enough, a little bit later, I got to go as a chaperone for this group to Japan, and I visited the monastery, and they had me marked as a possible weirdo to go over there, you know, and So I went, and it was really profound for me being with the Roshi and being in the monastery. And there's always an aspect of like, you're kind of like, are these yuppies playing dress up? You know, mm-hmm. What is this? But then there's this other aspect where it's like, oh, this is so it deeply affected me. I was going to the Roshi for, he allowed me to go for Sanzen, which is the private interview.
Yeah.
And he just sizes you up, you know, and I just went in there and I just cried, and it was very intense. And so it really hit me, you know, but came back, and I still just wanted to be a normal guy. I don't want to go do that training. That's crazy. You know? And then there was an O session again on the island, and day six was, September 11th, 9/11. Mm. And there was, so that one, that head monk I had talked about came into the, you know, day six, and day six, you're pretty raw as a new practitioner.
Yeah.
Anyway, he came in and, told us that the two planes had crashed, you know, so, it shook me up, and I realized, oh, I'm going now.
Right.
So that's how I ended up going to Japan.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So everything that you just described, so like going to Japan, people can actually see your experience in Japan because there is a film that exists that you posted on your website, Zen Embodiment, that details your experience in like sort of like a day in the life in a monastery. And so like people can go to your website and they can watch like 50 minutes of footage basically from like the time of a wake up until sleeping time in a monastery in Sogenji, Rinzai Zen Monastery, and you are in the film. Yeah. So tell me about this film. Like, why does this footage of this film exist that demonstrates the like a day in the life in this monastery?
Well, I think for the Japanese, they have a particular fascination with the foreigners who are there training. I think in some ways for them, Zen is a little bit like, you know, some form of Christianity here that people feel like is kind of tired and old, and maybe they've been there, done that. So they're just shocked by the fact that we are all these foreigners, these, you know, these really tall, strange, you know, foreigners, men and women, are there training for almost decades, you know, years and decades. And so I think for the Japanese, they have this, like, either it's this thing I don't care about, or it's so far and exotic, the training, that normal people don't do Zen training in Japan. They don't think it's possible. So the fact that we're doing it is pretty exciting and exotic for them.
Okay, so how long was this film crew in the monastery filming all this footage?
Yeah, they, I think it was like a year that they came and went, and we got to know them pretty well. They were really sweet people, very sincere. So through the film, there's some time lapse, right? It's
right.
Like it's winter and then it's spring or whatever, you know, and so that's a little confusing. And also the film was never finished, so it's the editing is a little bit tricky. So, and also they kind of wanted pyrotechnics. They mm-hmm. wanted things to be they didn't want to show anything that wasn't kind of fascinating.
Right, they wanted action, yeah.
Action, yep.
Okay, so in this film, you are in there a lot. So how old were you, do you think, when this film was made?
I think I was about 27, 28.
Okay.
Maybe turn 28 during the film, yeah.
So is this about halfway into your stay in the monastery?
Yeah.
Yep. How long were you there again?
Well, you know, that was all my 20s. So okay. After I went there, 23, that was it. You know, so I was just like there. And then I was here a little bit at the monastery. So, it was like 30, we were kind of out of there.
Okay, cool. So in the film, in the very beginning, it sort of shows like the morning wake-up routine in a Zen monastery. So people appear to be wearing very, very heavy coats inside. You can see their breath like... It's obviously very cold. And then early in the film, you are there and you hit a giant bell with a wooden hammer. So what does this mean?
Well, that was... So the first thing we do is we go to Choka. And Choka is the chanting. So we do that for like an hour.
Okay.
So you get up, someone says, Kaijo. So you wake up, someone yells Kaijo. You get up, and then you go immediately to go chant. Okay, and me ringing that bell is to call everyone to go to the hondo, the great hall, to chant. So that's, you know, everything in the monastery is done with a bell. So that way communication is kept to a minimum in that way. So honestly, what that does is, you know, I hear a bell and I start to smell rice, you know, right. Or whatever. You get very Pavlovian in that way. It's funny, yeah.
So after you hit this and you go into the hondo, the meditation hall in the morning for Zazen seated meditation, how long is the morning meditation?
So like 4 to 5 is Choka, and then you go back to the Zendo and chant just a little bit more, and then everyone runs to Sanzen. So in the video, you see people running, and that's right after Choka.
Okay.
So, and then that morning lasts until 7, or it did when I was there. I think it may have shifted slightly, but so that's 2 hours of Zazen and Sanzen with the Roshi.
Okay. So during the chanting, something that people who watch the footage will notice is the chanting, and this is... seriously intense. Like I was taught a little bit, like the Heart Sutra and the four great vows and chanting a little bit, and it's really, really hard. And the film clearly shows people who are like catching their breath during these chanting. So like, can you talk a little bit about the physicality of the chanting practice?
Yeah, I did write one blog post about that. But you know, everything in the monastery is about, you know, working with our ki, with our energy, okay? And the chanting is partly the reason we get up and go chant is because we get all of our energy flowing through the chanting. And everything with the Roshi starts with Sosokan. And Sosokan is a breathing technique where you extend your breath fully, and then you extend it a little further. And, of course, at first everyone forces that, but really, it's more about focus, and it's about getting into our bodies and letting them open up. So often with the chanting, you know, especially at first, you know, I had a lot of problems with the chanting. You're there, you know, you're trying to chant out, but half of you is going in. So a lot of the practice is about figuring out how to get your whole self moving in that one direction. So, you know, that you see that with people in the video, like they're working on that. They're figuring out how to get their, you know, their whole energy going in one direction. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's really a sight to behold. And in order to actually understand how difficult it is, I think that somebody actually has to try and do it.
Yeah.
So during Zazen, whenever you're seated, you have your hands placed in a really certain way. So a lot of times it'll be like a mudra where like one hand will be resting on top of the other, but then the thumbs will be pressed together in like sort of like an egg shape.
Yeah.
And in the film, I see that the hand mudra in the film is not with the tips of the thumbs touching like you see in some Zen photos. It's kind of like where you have the thumb inside of a fist and then you wrap your hand around the fist. So, like, do you have, like, a seated meditation mudra that you prefer? Because I've seen it done a bunch of different ways.
Well, I think officially, you know, for the pictures, they're going to do this normal kind of with mudra with the thumbs touching. But, you know, Rinzai's a little irreverent, to be honest. It's a little bit more... you know, there's a little less OCD on everything being done exactly perfect.
Mm.
It's not bad that's the way it is. And you know, Soto, I think, is a little more OCD on everything being done exactly, you know, the way Dogen said it or whatever. But the Rinzai, you know, it's a real physical practice. It's a real energetic practice. And a lot of us, you know, the Roshi would normally sit grabbing his thumb. You know, it's a little more like there's a little aspect, I think, where you can feel your tendon, but just below your navel, you can feel that a little bit differently by grabbing your thumb. And I personally like that better. I think if we're trying to do like this perfect mudra, I think people actually sometimes can't go as deep in their Zazen. They can't let go as much if they're trying to do this perfect mudra.
Okay, so, cool. I like that. I was always curious about that because I've seen it one way. Like our mutual friend Mado Moore has it with the grabbing of the thumb in his book.
Yeah.
And then I've seen people do it with the thumbs touching, like in sort of like the egg shape. And I was always just curious if there was like a specific reason for that. So sorry for getting a little too nerdy and technical there.
No.
So yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Sanzen, which you mentioned earlier. And there is a really intense scene in the film where there's a student and teacher meeting, and the student screams like full volume in the face of the teacher, and then the teacher screams back and rings a bell, and then the student bows. So what is the purpose of this? What is this practice known as? Like, why is there this yelling between the teacher and the student, and what is it all for?
Well, those two... Sanzens that you see are the first one is actually he's actually doing these additional questions after the Mu Koan, and then the second one is this traditional Mu Koan, and you know, Sanzen is like this meeting of energetic kind of soup, okay, and you are presenting your energetic state of mind, and the Roshi is there with his state of mind. And it's a blending of those. It's a meeting of minds. The Mu Koan is what you do actually is the shout is an expression of an energetic overflowing.
Mm.
So if done well, it's not force. So if you're really doing the Mu, it's exploding out from this overflowing of energy. So people think it's some kind of, you know, that you're yelling, but really, if you're doing it well, it just is emerging from this energetic overflow.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. So it's not like, so what else is like kind of like the purpose for anybody who doesn't know, like, of these meetings?
So the you're going in and you're trying to present your state of mind to the Roshi.
Okay.
And the Roshi's job is to, like, show you where you're off, show you where your state of mind is fuzzy or it's not sharp, or he finds your gap, and you are looking each time you go in, and it's like you're in this duel, okay, and you want to show him you got it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, And his job is to outdo you every time and beat you every time, and to show you, oh, you're wrong there. You're off there. You're missing it. So,
okay. So thinking back on your sons and experiences, like, what would you say is like the biggest things that you gain from doing a practice like sons and over a period of years, like with one teacher?
I would say that the Roshi is this master of, he's like this blacksmith who's forging his students to open up to their true nature. And for me, I found this deep level of relating and communicating energetically that completely changed my life. And he was, so the communication in Sanzen is there's a verbal aspect, sometimes you're talking, but really there's this whole under the table energetic aspect. And that's the real teaching. And so you're getting transmitted this Buddha state of mind. And you have to learn how to receive that. You have to learn how to embody and let it transform you and metamorphosize you. That's what Sanzen's about.
Cool. Okay, so when you were there, you don't just ring the bell and chant and sit and do Sanzen. You also work. And you were kind of like a kitchen guy, right?
I did all the jobs.
Okay, cool. Yeah. There's a guy that you probably know about, an author, Rinzai Monk, shows on Jack Hobner.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you read any of those books?
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Oh my gosh, those books are amazing. So he's got a scene in Zen Confidential where he's always like getting into fights with his kitchen staff and people in the monastery in California. So he's like getting into these huge like brawls in these kitchen scenes, and they are the most hilarious things ever. But your environment seems like super quiet and peaceful in the film, but there's probably more to it than what we see in the film, I would imagine. So you're surrounded by people. What's like the social scene like in a place like Sogenji? Like, are you friends with the people in the film? Is there socializing? Are you not supposed to talk to each other? Like, how does that go?
Well, when I was there, there was some social stuff really going on, and there's a whole brotherhood, sisterhood thing. As a new person, a kohai, you come and it's really helpful to have senpais there who've been there a little longer, and they have really transformed through their practice. They can really help a new person, and so there is a whole social aspect there. I had great friends, still great friends from that life. You're all kind of like these mavericky, kind of wild people who go there. You're there because you're some kind of rebel. And but I would say that in the monastery, it's like this oven where everyone is cooking and the heat is really high and people are really intense. They're going through all their shit. You know, it all comes up. And so there is conflict after conflict. It is a place of conflict. And, you know, people think, oh, you're going to go to this monastery. It's going to be so relaxing and everyone's going to be smiling the whole time. And really, everything in the monastery moves fast. Everything is intense. And the Roshi is the most intense. So it's, you know, the analogy of the, you know, you have these potatoes boiling in a pot. And everyone's all the skin gets boiled, you know, kind of rubbed off. That's
yeah.
So you think it's this sweet place, but it's really there can be violence. There it's a very intense environment.
Did you ever punch anybody?
No. I was a problem for a couple of years for sure. You know, we're doing this energetic work, opening up your body. You emotions come big time.
Yeah.
So, you know, and part of the deal is that you just have to sit with it. You just have to be with it. And then part of that, it just transforms you. You become tough, and you've had to face it for hour upon hour, and something changes.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So you said you're still friends with a lot of the folks that are in the film too?
Yes, very much so.
Awesome.
Much so. You know, it's like we went through something very intense together. So we you know, if someone walked in the door right now, I would just know they were a Sogenji person, because they'd have a certain type of intensity, a certain energetic flavor, or call it a kyogai. You know, they'd have a certain feel to them that you're a Sogenji person.
Yeah. So one of the surprises for me in the documentary is like the demographic makeup. So you're in Japan, but the demographics seem like strikingly Western. So what was the breakdown, like racial, gender? What was like the breakdown of like in the monastery?
Well, this is an experimental place. So, and this is a place really set up for foreigners.
Okay.
So, this is not the traditional Sodo, which is more, it's just Japanese people. You maybe have one person who's a foreigner. But so the Roshi's teacher, Yamada Mumon, his vision was to create a place for Westerners. And he sent our Roshi there to Sogenji to train Westerners, and not just Westerners, but there are people from India, Mexico, Australia, all over Europe, America, obviously. So, and men and women, I think, you know, honestly, about half.
Cool.
Yeah, half. Yeah.
How many people live there? Like when it's full?
When it's full, 50.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not like we got 1,000 people there. It's not like, you know, Joshu is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, about 50 for the tops usually. But it goes down to like 20 sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're doing all these things. You're working, you're sitting, you're chanting, you're doing sanzen. And then you get out of the monastery a little bit and into the community. So like I see some at various points in the film, I see members of the public in the film. So what was the monastery's role in public life for the locals in Japan? Like what services did you guys offer?
Well, the Roshi would lead he would give talks, and there was always some kind of festival going on, or some kind of ceremony of some kind. And we would do Sunday Zazenkai, which is the community Zazen. So people would come and from the community and sit Zazen with us. And I think we were this huge temple, and people would come for the new year. People, it's a big part of people's lives, I think. I'm not sure how much of Sogenji is given to funerals and whatnot. I think in some ways the more smaller temples were that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's always some kind of festival.
So there's also like these, like whenever the community is in there doing like Sunday Zazenkai, you see these like 70-something little old ladies like sitting or kneeling on the floor throughout like the whole film. So would they only come on like one day of the week?
Well, I mean, this is a training environment, so it's kind of like they're not going into this oven every day,
right?
You know, so they're going for this certain time. He would do this these little talks, Asahi culture. He would do these little talks, so there would be a group of very devoted, 70-year-old women who would come, and he would give a talk to, and it's their time, and they kind of take over, and they, you know, they get special time with the Roshi, and that's very important because the Roshi's very powerful, so they get to kind of soak that up a little. They're amazing. I mean, they're kneeling and all that. We should be able to do that too, but we just don't grow up doing it, you know?
Yeah. And so like whenever you're involved in the community, you guys also would have like businesses, right? Like I think I saw at one point in the film, like I saw like you guys like packing seed packages or something. Like how do you keep the lights on in a place like that in a modern, expensive society?
Well, you know, I think that actually what you saw may have been people just saving seeds from their own, from our garden.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, honestly, there's zero business at Sogenji.
Really?
It's all internally funded. This is a huge machine.
Okay.
The whole Japanese. This is like, you know, cathedral. This is a huge temple within a bigger machine. So huge funding from Japan.
Okay, cool.
Yoshin.
Yeah, because like whenever I think about like I read like a book about the history of the San Francisco Zen Center, and they like had like a farm and a restaurant and like a bakery and everything, and they were having businesses left and right, and they were like renting out their monastery for like summer like vacation and stuff. So that's interesting that there's kind of like a little different approach to funding the whole thing in Japan.
Well, this is a there is a philosophy behind that, and that I think the ideal is that people, if you have the ripeness of your practice, that people will fund it. Mm-hmm. This is the idea. And so theoretically, there shouldn't have to be a business, because people will want to support that organization if the essence is deep enough. So this is the idea in Japan, is that to work is maybe a little, it's not really recommended.
Okay. So then when you get out in the community a little bit, I saw some parts where you guys are walking through town and you're dressed differently inside the monastery versus when you're in town. So like there are these like rope shoes and these gigantic hats and like leggings that look like tights. So when someone is like in town, like why are you dressed differently when you walk through town, and what happens? Like why do you go out of the monastery into the town?
Well, that's called takuhatsu, and it's honestly for the community. So we actually go out in our ceremonial garb, okay? Ceremonial, like pilgrimage garb. And even people who are not ordained wear those clothes for takuhatsu, okay? So people who are just living there and they haven't taken the ordination vows, all that, they go to takuhatsu, and we go and it's honestly for the people to be able to support the monastery, that, and they don't give that much. It's not like we get a bunch of money, so or rice, you know. So it's more that the community can offer something to for their own practice. So we go for them, honestly.
Cool. And I know some people are wearing navy blue robes, some are wearing black when they're out on the walks. Like, is there any difference in the color of the robes that is important?
The winter robes are the denim.
Oh,
the
okay.
Are the black.
Okay.
So, yeah. So in the winter, you wear these beautiful denim, you know, robes. And the summer is this mesh sort of plastic thing.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I know that you were ordained. And I want to the last thing I want to talk about before we talk about your current businesses and your current life is your ordination. So your entire ordination is in the film, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they yeah, pretty much, yeah.
I mean, that is amazing that you are the one person who got their entire ordination in this film.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's like a long process that goes into it. So at the very beginning, you come out and you're wearing white in your ordination, and there's a person next to you. Who is with you in that ordination?
Oh, that's my very good friend, Sogaku, who's a Portuguese guy. He's actually a teacher now in a different lineage in Paris.
Okay.
But yeah, he's already ordained. So he was sort of my wingman, you know.
Nice.
Making sure I didn't mess up too much, which I'm very good at messing up. So yeah, so he kind of knew it and knew the steps. So he helped me to the choreography. You know, everything in Japan is about in the monastery and whatnot. There's a choreography. There's a ceremony for everything. So a lot of that whole ceremony is about just this whole ritual.
Okay. So then the Roshi gives you new clothing on a tray, and then you walk around with that. So what's the deal with the clothing on the tray that's wrapped up?
Well, I think the white symbolizes the lay person. So white usually symbolizes lay people in Japan. In the monastery. So, you know, layman, you know, paying would be wearing white and not black. So ordained people would wear black. So I go back and I put on my black robe, and then I'm a different person. I'm not a lay person anymore. So it's a symbolizing me going from a lay person to an ordained person.
And then when you got that, the Roshi shaved your head a little bit. And then gave you more clothes. So what were those steps?
So they gave me the kesa, which is the Buddha's you know, Buddhist robe. And that's the formal, that's the very formal long sheet that you wear. has lots of meaning, I'm sure. But yeah, so he shaved that. It was like, you know, something I'm getting, but something like shaving off my delusions, or, you know, final.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right. So, you know, it's a civilized ritual. Yeah.
Okay, cool. And then at the end, you received a really beautiful certificate, and I heard then the Roshi call you by the name Ichigen. So yeah. What does your ordained name mean?
Well, I had already had the name Ichigen, which means one. But he gave me a second name there, and that was Tairei. So I have two names there, Tairei Ichigen. And Tairei was a former Roshi at the monastery, and I'm not sure why he gave that to me. People don't normally get an ordination name, but my name, Ichigen, I had for a year or two before already. But yeah, Ichigen, yeah, that's my name.
Cool. Was any of your friends and family able to come to the ordination?
I did have a really good friend who had spent time with me at the little monastery here in the States. He had come, my good friend Chris Lanning, and then his folks were there. And then I had some friends who live in Japan who visited. My folks did not come, my family. For a lot of people, I think it's their folks aren't completely supportive of their time in the monastery. Yeah.
Okay. So do you think that Americans or Westerners should study Zen in Japan?
Well, I think if you have a what's called the great doubt, this is a great need, sort of your whole being needs to really discover, you know, this real truth. I think working with maybe the best teacher, best flavor for you that works is what you need to do. And I think that, you know, the Roshi is getting a little older now, but still the most sublime teacher I am aware of. So if, you know, everybody's got a little flavor that works for them, you know? So I would not tell anyone that they should go train with the Roshi. If you're like me, who, you know, extremely intense, wanting someone who could take any kind of intensity I could offer and be able to give me more, that was the Roshi, and I ate it up, soaked it up. So if you're looking for an intense environment, I would say you might want to check that out if you're pretty psychologically stable. That said, I don't think everyone needs to go to a monastery. I don't think that's not for everyone, and that's good, you know? And if you want to stay in the States, I think I like that Mato more. I think he's doing some cool stuff over there. I don't quite understand their schedule exactly, but I think he's doing real Rinzai training. And so I respect that.
Why'd you leave?
Well, I left because we came home and we started a family.
Oh, because you met your wife over there, right?
We did. And we left, and our karma changed, and we came home, and we had a whole life change. I was going to stay there for, you know, probably 10 more years. And I was like the Roshi's guy, you know. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was one of the starting lineup. You know, I was going to be a Roshi, you know. So then when our karma kind of shifted – then we came home, and we were going to try to figure out how to stay really involved, and then it didn't quite work out. So we left the scene, and we decided to, you know, move on and be our own people.
And you talked to me, like, we've been talking now a little bit offline for several weeks now, and you mentioned to me that the monastery is sort of like a breakout for you of sorts. So how did you navigate this reorienting of yourself in society, like with a normal like daily routine and like living in cities and coming back to the States and all that? How did that reorienting happen for you?
I think that the training and the Zazen, it all gives you this internal compass, you know, and so you have your own way of working with this true nature and with the universe, and so for me, I had to just creatively work on maintaining and working with that. You know, so there's a whole term in Japanese Zen called kufu, and kufu means creative problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's been this just wonderful artistic kufu about how to figure out how to offer myself in the world in a meaningful way, you know, artistic way. So it's all tied into the training. So it's like our whole lives are still the training. We're still expressing that. We're still working with that. It's just in a slightly different venue.
So Corey Hess body therapy is like something that you do like for a living, right?
Yep.
Okay. So you offer several services in your body therapy profession called structural integration, source point therapy, and craniosacral therapy. And these are things that I'm not super versed on. So first of all, what kind of is like the purpose of the business? And then maybe you could describe a little bit about what these services do.
Yeah, well, you know, people come in with certain issues. You know, they come with sciatica, or they come with you know, postural issues or headaches or anything like that. And the structural integration, before I went to Japan, I went through a whole the Rolfing series. And so structural integration was developed by Dr. Ida Rolf. And there are different schools of structural integration. One of them is Rolfing, which you may have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to a slightly different school. I went to the Soma Institute. But I was really impressed by the whole structural integration mindset. It was pretty out of the box, and dealing with you know, human potential and what gravity was and how to align ourselves with you know, gravity and this concept of a line, which felt very much like an energetic aspect of Zazen. So that's how I got into structural integration. I came back looking for a medium to communicate with people. I felt like I had learned from the Roshi this very profound way of relating and communicating and being sort of not intimate in a sexual way, but just intimate with people. And so I was looking for a way to express myself, and so that's what I chose. Craniosacral is very very similar to Zazen in a lot of ways for me. It's about you're sort of like a tuning fork. I sort of do Zazen with people, and so you're working with energy fields and alignment and allowing the system to self-organize. This is all very much very similar to Zazen. Source point was developed by a Rolfer who was a really high level Kaplo Roshi student, and it's sort of like energetic Rolfing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been like a whole other language for me to figure out how to express myself after the training. So there's been a pretty cool marriage for me between you know, Zazen, the training, koan work, and source point. It's all sort of in this. It's all very similar to me.
So this is kind of like a way to like bring the energy work that you were talking about earlier, kind of out, off the cushion, out of the monastery and sort of into the world, right?
Yeah. You know, as Zen people, the whole life there is about saving, you know, all beings, right? So we're sitting for ourselves, you know, we're trying to just, you know, get ourselves together. And then we have certain experiences, different breakthroughs, Kensho, Satori, all these things, they happen. And, you know, then it's really about how do we offer ourselves to the world? And for me, I was looking for a way to offer myself to society. And, you know, I'm still working on that. The blog is very much about that. How can I creatively help people to open up to their potential and open up to something deep and beautiful they don't know exists? So, yeah.
How has the blog called Zen Embodiment, how has the blog helped you process lessons and memories from the monastery as you go about your life in like the world as a parent and a spouse and as a professional?
Yeah. You know, it's, I really believe in art, actually. I really believe that, you know, talking again about this internal compass, you know, I feel like the Zazen gave me this, this real access to this truth and a way to interact with it cellularly. And, I feel like in a way the art is very similar to that. It's like the more I try to express something that's true, the more I have to engage with this internal compass, and the more true that then the art becomes. So it's a way to kind of check myself and explore and how to really relate to people and how to help people. That's what I'm trying to do.
Nice. And you told me via email, there's a quote in one of your emails that I loved. It said, many monastics have a hard time integrating their training into a good, harmonious life. I write my blog to show that it really is possible. So it's almost kind of to me like you are like the equivalent of like a university professor in the ivory tower, you know, and yes. Some of those folks have a really, really hard time communicating their expertise to people who don't have their training in physics or chemistry or animal sciences or whatever. And it seems like you do. It seems like you have a good ability to bring the sort of ivory tower phenomenon to ordinary language that people can get.
Boy, I'm working on it. Yeah. I really feel, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm figuring out how to do it, you know, and I feel like it's very important to demystify some of this. The blog is for a few different people. It's for people who are just starting out. Some of the blog posts are about how can we just engage with our process? How can we really start to get involved in that and know there is a process? And then that's also for very serious people. Some of my monk friends in the monastery read it, and it's my way to be a senpai to them and to help them to say, you can break through. You can really do this. You can transform. You can you know, metamorphosize through this work. And then it's also, you know, for some of my buddies who are out and they're, again, trying to figure out how to, you know, bring it all into their lives. How can we do that? And the blog is, again, it's for me, it's my own way of exploring that and trying to express something real and true. And so I write it for myself, and I write it for all those other people too. So, yeah.
How does, so I loved your entry. One of them in particular that I was thinking about is Zen Dad.
Yeah.
So I have a daughter too. So how does your Zen practice and the training that you have undergone, how does that influence your parenting?
Well, I think they very easily, can, realize or they really, they're connected with their true nature, I think. So I think trying to let that really thrive and flourish within them. So I think we're trying to help that to just naturally exist. That's what we're trying to do as parents, is let their spirits really kind of soar. That's our hope. Is I think we went to do a lot of this training, I think, to, you know, kind of shake off a bunch of filters that we had built upon ourselves. You know, the Zen monk is a person that's, you know, they're not perfect. They're not doing anything perfect, but their filter is very, they don't have filter so much. So they're right there. They're fresh. And I think that kids have this fresh state of mind. And So we're just trying to help that to flourish. Try not to get in the way too much. You know, that's what we're trying to do.
Nice. Well, Corey Hess, author, yes, former Zen monk, body therapist. Tell everybody who's listening, like, where they can find all of your writing and your professional endeavors on the interwebs.
Well, my business site is CoreyHessBodyTherapy.com, and my blog is actually on there as well. But the more well-known blog is the ZenEmbodiment.com, and yeah, that's where it is. I'm out on Whidbey Island and north of Seattle, Salish Sea.
You always invite for comments on all of your website postings as well, don't you?
Yes, I love to hear comments. I love to be able to be helpful in any way that people have. I often get questions from people from, you know, people from Poland are writing me about different energetic problems they're having, or issues, or questions about Zazen, and I really enjoy that. That's really fun, especially some of these issues that nobody seems to have a way to talk about. You know, a lot of us Zen people, we've been through a lot of that, sitting on the cushion for all those hours. You know, we've banged our head in all enough, and then we kind of just stopped, you know. And so we've been through a lot of these issues. So I'm happy to hear any questions or comments. I love getting comments like, oh, that really helped me. You know, I'm not getting paid for my blog, so it's very nice to hear, oh, that was helpful.
Nice. Well, Corey Hess, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about your monastery experience and all of your professional work today. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
As mentioned in the introduction, here is the full English version of the Heart Sutra chanted by Corey Hess.
Pa prajna paramita idara sutra avalokiteshvara bodhisattva. When practicing deeply the prajna paramita, perceive that all five skandhas in their own being are empty and was saved from all suffering. All Shariputra form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness form, the same is true of feeling, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are without birth or death, are not tainted, nor pure, nor increased, nor decreased. Therefore, in emptiness, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no impulses, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no world of eyes, through to no world of mind, consciousness, no ignorance, and also no extinction of it, through to no old age and death, and also no extinction of no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no cognition, also no attainment with nothing to attain. The bodhisattvas depend on prajnaparamita, and their mind is no hindrance, without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every deluded view, they dwell in nirvana, in the three worlds of Buddhas, depend on prajnaparamita, and that's complete perfect enlightenment. Therefore, no. The prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, is the great bright mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is labeled to relieve all suffering and is true enough. Also proclaim the prajnaparamita mantra, proclaim the mantra that says yate, yate, para, yate, parasam, yate, bodhisva.
Classical Ideas is produced by me, Greg Soden. Music on Classical Ideas is composed and performed by Derek Streibig. You can find his music at www.wearewarmmusic.com. If you like this show, please rate it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email me at classicalideas@outlook.com or find me on Patreon at patreon.com/classicalideaspodcast. Thanks so much for listening.